first to a conversation I conducted in Dublin earlier this year, exploring the memories and the myths of the Easter Rising 100 years ago exactly. The commemorations were based around the tagline, Remember, Reflect, Reimagine. So it was a lovely counterpoint to discover some thought-provoking new thinking from the American writer and ex-war correspondent David Reith, who's become something of an habitué of Ireland. And we received a lot of feedback from you, some agreeing with him, some ardently opposed. His new book was launched in Dublin when I was there. It's called In Praise of Forgetting: Historical Memory and Its Ironies. He relates it very much not just to centenary celebrations, but today's dilemmas, say the abuse of collective memory in today's Middle East. I met him in a Dublin bookshop by chance, and we made our way to a rather noisy cafe so David could explain his thesis in greater detail. David, welcome.
Thank you.
We'll just cope with all the cappuccinos being made beside us. Why ought we reconsider forgetting?
Well, one of the pieties of the age is that you must remember, that that's the moral thing to do. And it's exemplified in the phrase of the American philosopher George Santayana, who said...
Which came from Edmund Burke, I'm told, originally, as an Irishman.
There it is. So he nicked it, did he? Ah, I didn't know that. Anyway, the phrase was, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. And first of all, I don't see any evidence for this. Did remembering the Shoah, the murder of European Jewry by the Nazis, stop anyone from killing anyone in Rwanda or Cambodia or pretty much anywhere else? I think you'd have a hard time proving that.
It's possible it stopped Europeans from doing that. I mean, is it possible to say that it did work on people of European heritage?
Well, Europe was transformed as a result of World War II, but I'm not sure it's memory that did it. I mean, first of all, Germany was defeated, and you can impose, if a country is completely defeated, the victors can impose memory, just as they can impose a political system or anything else they pretty much want to do. In all likelihood, what put an end to Western European wars was the common market, was the European Union. And I don't think that was based on memory. I think that was based on another vision of Europe, you know, which comes out of World War II, but isn't the same thing. So all I wanted to do in this book was to say, look, I'm sure it's very moral to remember, and I'm sure there are lots of examples we can give where memory is very useful, and where the conventional view is absolutely the right view. But sometimes it's not. And I was a war correspondent in places like, precisely, Rwanda, Bosnia, Israel, Palestine. And there, it seems to me, memory has been quite toxic. And even in this country, Ireland, the place where we're sitting and talking right now, the memories collided. You know, in the north, a Republican's memory is different from a loyalist memory, unionist memory, if you prefer.
Well, in fact, you say it could well be that relinquishing memories is the moral thing to do if you're interested in peace.
There are people who think that all good things in the world go together. For example, in the human rights movement, you say you can't have peace without justice. And I think, on the contrary, one has to choose between different goods, often. And that often, for example, you choose between peace and justice. I mean, a good example of that would be South Africa. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it was decided by the victorious African National Congress government that they wanted to get at the truth of what the apartheid regime had done, but they weren't very interested in punishment. So you could go to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and you could say what you'd done and you'd go home for your dinner. Now, that's truth, but it sure isn't justice. I'm not saying that critically. I support that and think that that was the right decision. But it just gives you an example of how complicated things really are.
One of the very provocative things you say is that where you don't have a clear victory, you have often incompatible memories side by side, which, if I understand you correctly, is where it's particularly challenging.
I think it can be disastrous. And, you know, if you go to Belfast today, you still go from neighborhoods where the Union Jack is flying or where the Irish tricolor is flying. And you can't tell me those people have compatible memories. They have to achieve what the English philosopher John Gray calls a modus vivendi. That's the best they're going to do. There was an Irish politician, a couple of generations ago called Connor Cruz O'Brien, who said long before the Easter Sunday agreement that finally did put an end to the troubles in the North, that there'd been lots of negotiations and that sometimes they'd gotten very close until, as he put it, one side or the other remembered one of those damn songs. And then all was lost again. And then, you know, people were back in their myths. I mean, you alluded earlier to this sign that, it says 1916, 2016. How will you remember, reimagine? Well, first thing to say is you won't remember because you weren't there. Your father and mother weren't there. Your grandfather and mother weren't there. You don't remember anything. And actually, talk to any police officer, and that person will tell you that witness testimony starts to deteriorate after about 6 weeks. So nobody remembers the rising. Collective memory, political memory, remembrance, that's not memory.
No, but you make the point, again, you say people can't have a vacuum. They need memory frameworks in order to live life. I think that's what you say anyway, because there's certainly nothing simple about your thesis. So what do we do if we... You can't just be stalled, can you, between neither remembering nor forgetting?
I think the most smart people would say is find out the truth, establish the record, and then eventually forgive. But remember, I don't belong to that great group of smart, nice people. I think sometimes you have to forget, and it can be done. Nietzsche, the philosopher Nietzsche, talked about active forgetting. Look, it's not going to be all the time. Most of the time, what's going to happen is myths will gradually shift.
Fair enough, but I do wonder how your searing experience in Bosnia, I wonder how much it's infused your thinking. Could you tell the story about the piece of paper handed to you by an official at the time?
Sure. I was in Belgrade in Serbia during the Bosnian War in the early part of the 90s. It was a nationalist guy, very hard line about Serbian nationalism. And I interviewed him, and when I was leaving, one of his aides gave me a folded up piece of paper. So I was going back to the hotel, I opened it up and it said 1453, which is the date when Christian Constantinople fell to the Ottomans. So as far as this guy was concerned, they were fighting the Ottomans. The Ottomans were trying to take over Europe, and brave Serbia was, Orthodoxy was fighting back. There are lots of examples of this. In 1981, there was a small war in Lebanon, and the Israeli army surrounded PLO, or Palestinian Authority people, Arafat and the others, in some part of Beirut. And Menachem Begin, the then Prime Minister of Israel, said, "We have the Nazis surrounded." Well, that seems to be to express everything that's wrong with remembrance.
But isn't Germany what Germany's done, where they've both, seems to me anyway, remembered, reflected, and certainly reimagined and got on with life? In other words, they've held on to the ambiguities and kept moving on. I sort of think that's admirable.
Well, but they were totally defeated people, and they had this version imposed on them. In other words, we should have the option of forgetting.
Well, in fact, let's apply it to the present day, because you bring it right up to the way memory is being abused, collective memory is being positively abused in Islamism at the moment. So can you develop that for me, please?
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, when Osama bin Laden and now ISIS or Daesh or whatever you want to call them talk about their enemies in the West, they talk about them as crusaders, as if there's an unbroken link between the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem and, established in 1099 and the Americans in Iraq today. I mean, that's a complete distortion of memory. Mind you, it's on all sides. Again, the Israelis do a fair bit of that themselves. But I think the creating of what is a preposterous version of the historical record is a particular specialty right now of the Islamist world. I mean,
Say the Crusaders as proto-Zionists.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, in fact. And, but I don't want to single them out. I think memory is, I think talking about those examples as if they were abuses of memory, that is to say, as if there were some sort of, by definition, good use of memory, is a very dubious proposition for the simple reason that who's going to adjudicate that?
Look, you do quote Yeats, the great Yeats line at the start of your book, "Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart." I was intrigued why you actually used that.
Because I myself am very suspicious of myth and notions of sacrifice. I mean, one of the great leaders of the Irish Revolution, Patrick Pearse, you know, he wanted a blood sacrifice. And I think that's what Yeats, to some extent, was actually referring to. It was an answer to Pearse. But it's also, it's too poetical for me. When the poets take over the history, a lot of people bleed and die, is my view. You know, there was a governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, who used to say, you campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose. And I'm all for prose.
I like it. Okay, so look, what are you actually asking us? Are you asking us to stand somewhere in some limbo?
Well, unfortunately, the church has abolished limbo, much to my chagrin. It's really... What do I think? I think that we should have the option, in a world of dueling fanaticisms, of forgetting. And there are historical precedents for it. Memory isn't the truth. So if it's not the truth, that we should then have a much more utilitarian relation to it, pragmatic relation to it. And sometimes it will be good to remember, sometimes it will be good to forget. And that doesn't seem to me such a radical claim, even though, of course, given the, you know, moral consensus of the moment, I reluctantly concede that it is.
Well, David Reif, I hope you never write poetry. But thank you very much indeed. Thanks for battling with all the noises around us.
Thanks for having me on.
David Reif, R-I-E-F-F, by the way. His book is In Praise of Forgetting, and it's published by Yale University Press. It's not a long read, so very doable in this, what can be a rather busy time.